It is one of the oldest original ballparks in the country, and with that lengthy run is an interesting history as well. Today we're discussing Wrigley Field, the diamond on the north side. I'm Tommy Henry, and this is the Chicago History Podcast. While baseball has been played at the corner of Clark and Addison for more than 100 years, this episode won't talk too much about America's favorite pastime. Let's be honest, there are plenty of sports podcasts for that. This episode will talk more about the ballpark and the developments on that corner over the years. The more you know about Wrigley Field, the more you realize it is pretty amazing that it still exists in its current form. I'll get to the reasons for that in a moment. For now, we're going back to the 1800s. Actually, before the 1800s. The area that would eventually become Lakeview had been home to Illinois, Miami, and Potawatomi tribes, with Algonquin, Sac, Fox, and Kickapoo Indians also in the territory. Some of the first to settle in the area now called Chicago's North Side were German and Swiss immigrants who developed the empty land for farming. In addition to vast pickle farms, it has been said at one time the area to the north helped Chicago achieve the title of Celery Capital of the World. Weird brag. The first white Northside settler was immigrant Conrad Sulzer, born in Switzerland, who lived in France and Watertown, New York, before arriving in Chicago in 1836. Sulzer bought 100 acres of land near what is now Clark Street and Irving Park Road, roughly a half mile from present-day Wrigley Field. Sulzer would eventually sell off portions of his land for use as Graceland Cemetery. Cholera outbreaks in Chicago in 1849 and 1854, and eventually again in 1866, saw people heading north into Lakeview for less congested and potentially safer areas. While many were looking to support themselves and their family through agriculture, others saw the potential for real estate. According to the book Wrigley Field by Stuart Shea, one of those who saw promise in the sandy land dotted with few trees was developer Joseph Sheffield. Joseph Earl Sheffield, born in Southport, Connecticut in 1793, was a cotton broker, railroad financier, and a philanthropist who founded Lakeview in 1837. Back then, the town of Lakeview went from Fullerton Avenue to the south, Devon to the north, Lake Michigan to the east, and Western Avenue all the way to the west. Lakeview's town hall was built at Halsted and Addison Street in 1872. It was eventually torn down and replaced by the Chicago Police Department's 23rd District Town Hall headquarters. While the police moved down the street to a more modern space, the town hall building still stands. Around 1851, Sheffield bought large parcels of land, including the one now bordered by Clark, Waveland, Sheffield, and Addison. In 1857, Lakeview officially became a township, taking the name from the area's proximity to Lake Michigan. After the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, many left without homes decided to move north to start anew. The influx of families was so great, it even necessitated the building of Lakeview High School in 1874. That school, built on the corner of Irving Park Road and Ashland, was the first township high school in the state and still operates today, roughly a mile from Wrigley Field. Between 1870 and 1887, the population of Lakeview Township grew from 2,000 residents to 45,000. Shopping, hotels, and bars began to appear in the area to cater to the area's masses. Lakeview was incorporated as a city in 1887. With the unabated growth of Lakeview, Chicago sought to annex the city of Lakeview. David Goodwillie, an early advocate for the annexation, said of the plan, quote, "It is a locality peculiarly fitted for the homes of the working classes. Cable cars and steam roads and fresh, clean property at low prices invite such people here." For Chicago, annexation of these adjoining towns and cities would increase the city's population and resulting tax base. For areas like Lakeview, the townspeople would benefit from the city services, like sewers, which citizens of Lakeview demanded after yet another cholera outbreak in the early 1880s. Fun fact, Lakeview's pre-annexation revenue came from sources such as toll gates on several street corners, where pedestrians and those traveling on horse-drawn carriages had to pay to get past. One of those toll gates was where present-day Clark and Waveland Avenue meet, on the northwest corner of the ballpark lot. Of course, members of the Lakeview government, not eager to give up their power, fought the annexation, but were eventually overruled, with Lakeview becoming part of Chicago in 1889. By then, Lakeview had already started to turn from farmlands to city. The first phone lines were wired in the area in 1883, and by 1905, over 3,300 residents had phones. Here's a little background about the streets that surround present-day Wrigley Field. Clark Street, originally called Green Bay Road, was renamed in honor of General George Rogers Clark, a Revolutionary War hero who was responsible for capturing much of the Northwest Territory, including what is now Illinois, from the British. Addison Street was named for Dr. Thomas Addison of Guy's Hospital, London. Addison was the first to describe a disease of the endocrine glands that causes anemia, since named for him, Addison's anemia. Not as sexy as the Revolutionary War thing, right? BT Dubs, I could find no record of Thomas Addison ever visiting Chicago. Sheffield to the east, well, that's an easy one. Land developer Joseph Sheffield named it for himself. Waveland on the north side of the ballpark was originally called Nellie Street, and the Chicago and Evanston Railroad, which ran north past the west side of the property, traveled parallel alongside Stella Street, which appears to have been part of what we now call Seminary Avenue. Digging a little more, I found there was also a Nellie Avenue that was also renamed to Waveland Avenue, and according to William Martin's 1948 Guide to Chicago Street Renaming, it was Joseph Sheffield who coined Waveland because the adjoining portions of land often became submerged during storms. Fun with maps! By the late 1860s, the property bounded by present-day Clark, Addison, Waveland, and Sheffield had been transferred to Lutheran minister William Passavant, who planned to build a seminary on the land to train preachers that would minister to the area's German and Swedish population. St. Mark's Lutheran Church was constructed on the land facing Addison in 1874. That small chapel also served as a seminary until the Chicago Lutheran Seminary officially opened on October 1, 1891, with just 6 students. The President's House was constructed at the corner of Sheffield and Waveland in 1892, and 1 year later, the seminary spent $25,000, nearly $900,000 today, to build Eliza Hall, a 4-story building that housed the library, chapel, lecture hall, and student rooms. The 1894 Sanborn fire map shows Eliza Hall facing Waveland at Clarence Avenue, since renamed Kenmore Avenue. Just to the west of the seminary was the Hildebrandt Coal Factory, which provided coal for heating to local houses and businesses. The noise and chaos from the coal factory, as well as other industries like area lumber yards, started to take their toll on the seminary. One young student would later complain to the coal yards, quote, "Smoke, dust, grime, soot, dirt, foul gases, railroading by night and day, whistles, ding-donging of bells late and early and in between times, the unsanctified men in charge sending the unsterilized particles, odors, and speech into the homes, eyes, and ears of the seminary habitants." The once quiet farmlands of Lakeview became even less so when the elevated train stop at Addison opened on June 6, 1900, giving a significant boost to transportation options for those on the north side. While this certainly helped those who needed a quick trip south to downtown Chicago, this was another sign to the seminary that it might be time to go. The seminary vacated the property in 1910 and moved to Maywood, approximately 17 miles west and a little bit south, where it remained until 1967. The Chicago Lutheran Seminary later merged with other seminaries to form the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, currently operating at 54th and Cornell in East Hyde Park. As early as 1905, there were rumors in the sports community that the Minor League American Association was looking to establish a presence in Chicago. As the American League's White Sox were on the south side and the National League's Chicago Cubs were on the west side, Milwaukee Brewers owner Charles Havener saw a chance to get in on the action if the American Association set up a team in Chicago, with the north side being the most logical setting for that to occur. As the seminary was looking to vacate their property, Havener and other investors bought it from them for $175,000, more than $6 million today. While Havener and other investors were hopeful they could keep their recent purchase out of the news, that went out the window when members of the seminary board loudly complained that the property should have fetched $200,000. The American Association, not wanting to incur the wrath of the major leagues, did not pursue a move to Chicago. Havener's gamble did not pay off, and he sold his interest in the property to his other investors before his death in April of 1912. The seminary buildings were then converted into residential units. In 1913, the Federal League of Baseball Clubs began with franchises in six major cities, including Chicago. The Chicago team, known as the Chi-Feds, played their games on the fields at DePaul University. One of the men brought on to help guide the Chi-Feds was Charles Wiegman, who had made his fortune with local lunch counters, kind of the old-timey version of fast food places. With plans of going big time, Wiegman relocated his Federal League team to the former grounds of the seminary at Clark and Addison, securing a 99-year lease on the property in December of 1913. Charles Wiegman hired architect Zachary Taylor Davis, who also designed Comiskey Park, and Taylor's brother, Charles G. Davis, to design the new ballpark at Clark and Addison. Work on the new venue did not begin until February 23, 1914, which gave workers just 2 months until the Chi-Feds' scheduled home opener. Once the grounds were cleared of most of the existing buildings, groundbreaking ceremonies took place on March 4th. Shockingly, between the beginning of March 1914 and the third week of April that year, the new park was completed just in time for the April 23, 1914 home opener between the Chi-Feds and the Kansas City Packers. Opening day at Wiegman Field saw 18,000 seated guests, although 21,000 fans packed the stadium. Hundreds more watched the game from the rooftops of buildings along Sheffield and Waveland, and others tried to get a peek from the elevated platform on Addison. In an April 1914 picture of the newly built Wiegman Park, Eliza Hall can be seen just beyond the left field fence. Someone living there still had time left on their lease, so the ballpark owners had to wait. Because of the location of the former Eliza Hall building, batters found it easy to homer out of left field. Ballpark officials discovered the back porch on Eliza Hall was not part of the lease, so they had it removed and were able to move the outfield fence back several feet by May 1914. By the 1915 season, the building would be demolished to make more room for the ballpark. It was also during the 1950 season that the Chicago Federals, or the Chi-Feds, adopted the name Whales. The team even included the logo of a whale inside a large C on their uniform shirts. The Whales had a successful season, winning the league championship with 86 wins and 66 losses, percentage points ahead of the St. Louis Terriers' record of 87 and 67. I mentioned the L at Addison earlier. Between 1914 and 1917, you could take a train from Union Station to Wrigley Field, and Clark Street had its own streetcar lines until 1958. Train tracks ran along the west wall of the park, about where Gallagher Way and the Ernie Banks statue is today. And before I forget, the structure on the southwest corner of Waveland and Seminary, just beyond the left outfield wall of Wrigley, houses Chicago Fire Department Company 78, which was built in 1915. That firehouse was designed by Charles W. Kalal in a Renaissance Revival style. An earlier structure used by the fire department was built on that same spot in 1894. While the 1915 structure was being built, Engine Company 78 temporarily relocated to a public garage at Halsted and Melrose. The firehouse was listed as a Chicago landmark in 2003. The Federal League was forced to disband after the Chicago Whales winning season, but Charles Wiegman was allowed to buy the Cubs for $500,000, moving them out of their West Side Stadium and into Wiegman Field for the 1916 season. A number of former Chicago Whales players joined the Cubs roster. The Chicago Cubs played their first game at Wiegman Field on April 20th, 1916, beating the Cincinnati Reds 7-6 in 11 innings. Although Charles Wiegman was the top name in the Chicago Cubs organization, there were other minority investors in the franchise, including chewing gum magnate William Wrigley. Over the next 2 years, Charles Wiegman's fortunes began to fall, giving Wrigley the chance to acquire additional shares in the club. In November of 1918, Charles Wiegman gave up his remaining shares, resigned as president, and left baseball. Wiegman's fortunes did not improve over the next two decades. If you listen to my episode about the Ku Klux Klan in Chicago, you may remember that on August 16, 1921, Wiegman sponsored the first statewide KKK rally in Illinois, which drew 12,000 Klansmen to Wiegman's property in Lake Zurich, Illinois, where more than 2,000 new Klan members were initiated. Wiegman headed east to New York City, where he tried and failed to start restaurants three more times before dying of a stroke at the Drake Hotel in Chicago in 1938 at the age of 64. At the time of his death, he reportedly was working as an assistant manager at a restaurant in Fort Lee, New Jersey. From the time of Wiegman's departure until the end of 1926, the ballpark at Clark and Addison was known as Cubs Park. On December 3rd of 1926, the board of directors voted to officially rename the venue Wrigley Field to honor William Wrigley Jr. In attendance was William Vack Sr., who was the Cubs president from 1919 until his death in October 1933. Fun fact, Wrigley Field in Chicago was not the first Wrigley Field in the United States. William Wrigley owned a minor league team called the Los Angeles Angels that played at a ballpark called Wrigley Field, which opened in 1925, more than a year before Wiegman Park was renamed. For my West Coast listeners, that Wrigley Field was at 42nd Place in San Pedro, about 2 miles southeast of the Coliseum. It was demolished in 1969. That land is now home to the Gilbert Lindsay Community Center and the Kendron Community Mental Health Center. With the recent addition of a new tenant, the Chicago Staley's football team, which became the Chicago Bears, Wrigley hired architect Charles Davis to expand the ballpark in 1922. Davis's plan called for portions of the grandstands behind home plate and down the left field lines to be moved closer to Addison to the south and Waveland to the north. Permanent outfield grandstands would be constructed, and the level of the playing field would be lowered by 3 feet. The field's new dimensions would be 325 feet, 447 feet, and 318 feet. The ballpark's updated capacity would be 20,000. The remodeling cost, $300,000, about $5.6 million in today's value. Just 5 years later, the most significant modifications to the park were put in place in 1927 and 1928. It was then that the grandstands were double-decked down the third and first base lines, which increased Wrigley Field's capacity to 38,400. This allowed the Chicago Cubs to become the first baseball team to surpass attendance of 1 million visitors in a single season. It was around this time that a small brick building was built just outside the left field corner gate, which contained a six-room apartment occupied by the Cubs groundskeeper during the 1930s. That would make it the best commute to work ever. Since we're in the 1930s, let's talk about the iconic marquee on the southwest corner of the park at the main entrance. That was installed in 1934 and was originally painted green and read Home of the Cubs. By 1939, the sign was repainted dark blue and the wording changed to Home of Chicago Cubs. In March of 1960, the sign was repainted again, this time red. As for the LED message board on the marquee, that was introduced in 1982. 10 years after the ballpark stands received the double deck, architects Hollerbird and Root were brought on in 1937 to make even more changes, including the redesign of the bleachers, which were arranged in a boomerang-shaped configuration to replace the outfield grandstands. This is also when the center field scoreboard was installed. Originally brown, it wouldn't become the familiar green color until 1941, which was also when the clock at the top of the scoreboard was added. The scoreboard is still operated manually today, with score by innings and pitchers' numbers changed by hand. And since we're talking about Wrigley Field in the 1930s, we need to talk about one of Wrigley's most recognized features, the ivy on the outfield wall. For decades, the story told is that Bill Veeck Jr., son of longtime Cubs president William Veeck Sr., not only came up with the idea of the ivy, but was hands-on with getting it in place. Veeck even repeated the story in his autobiography, originally published in 1962, claiming he and grounds superintendent Bobby Doerr planted the ivy just before the final home series of the 1937 season. Taking Veeck at his word, writers have continued sharing this as Wrigley gospel, but baseball historians say that's a myth. According to Cubs historian Ed Hardig, in addition to the 1937 upgrades with the bleachers and scoreboard, there was an effort to beautify Wrigley. Owner P.K. Wrigley directed his organization to make the ballpark greener to reinforce the perception that Wrigley Field was, quote, a park and not a stadium. Bill Veeck Jr. had seen the ivy on the walls of minor league ballparks in Pasadena, California, and in Indianapolis, Indiana, and suggested it to P.K. Wrigley, who liked the idea. Elmer Clavey and family, well-known horticulturists in the area who had taken care of Wrigley's properties in Illinois and Wisconsin for many years, were hired to do the job. Veeck may have strung a few vines, but it was the Claveys who did most of the work. And for you horticulture nerds, the diamond in the ivy, as the Boston ivy used was nicknamed by the Baseball Hall of Fame, is mixed with Japanese bittersweet vines for stronger growth. One of the most memorable sporting events that occurred at Wrigley Field was not baseball related. It was when the Chicago Bears battled the Washington Redskins in the 1943 NFL Championship game, on December 16, 1943, in front of 34,320 fans. In a game in which the Bears were favored to win by a touchdown, the team won by 20 points, 41-21, with Bears quarterback Sid Luckman throwing 5 touchdown passes. While the Redskins took a 7-0 lead in the second quarter, the Bears would take the lead shortly after and never look back. In addition to his touchdown passes, Luckman recorded 286 passing yards and rushed for 64. Good old number 3, Bronco Nagurski, rushed for a touchdown. On January 23rd and again on January 30th, 1944, ski tournaments were held at Wrigley Field. On the first of the two dates, 52 skiers competed in front of 6,387 spectators. The winning jump was 89 feet by a Sergeant Torger Tokel, cool name, a native of Norway who was on leave from Camp Hale, Colorado. I mentioned the coal companies to the west of Wrigley Field. One eventually became the Collins and Weiss Coal Company, which remained in operation there until 1961, when the property was sold and the 5 towering coal silos were demolished. Henry's Drive-In, which bought the property, built a restaurant and a 200-car parking lot on the site, rumored to be the largest real estate deal involving a drive-in to date. In 1988, Wrigley Field became the last ballpark to use lights for night games, 40 years after the Detroit Tigers added lights at Briggs Stadium. So, What took so long? Well, you can blame the neighbors. Much like when people move to Linkin Park near an established music venue, then complain about the noise and eventually get the bar shut down, Lounge Acts and others, Wrigley Field neighbors, already frustrated by the 81-day games and the noise, traffic, and parking problems caused by those games, fought against the lights. While the Wrigley family allegedly pledged to never install lights while they owned the ballpark, the Tribune Company, which bought the Cubs in 1981, made no such promise. There was even a neighborhood group called Cubs. That stands for Citizens United for Baseball in Sunshine. That lobbied for a bill that would ban sporting events that generated noise levels above 45 decibels after 10 p.m., which would mean no public address systems, no organ music, etc. Without the ability to get loud, no night games could be played, so there would be no need for lights. The urgency for lights came about in 1985, when the Cubs made the postseason for the first time since 1945. While they were in first place on Father's Day in 1985, representatives from Major League Baseball informed the team that if they made it to the World Series, all of their games would need to be played on the road due to their inability to host night games. The first intended game with lights at Wrigley Field on August 8, 1988 against Philadelphia was rained out after 3.5 innings, so the first official night game at Wrigley Field was played the following night, August 9, 1988, when the Cubs beat the Mets 6-4. This game ended the streak of 5,687 home day games. The Chicago Cubs were originally allowed just 18 night games per year and none on the weekends. This has been amended over the years, and the current night game count is 35, along with approval for concerts and other events that require illumination. Speaking of concerts and noise, music acts that have played at Wrigley Field have included The Police, Phish, AC/DC, Pearl Jam, Dave Matthews, Foo Fighters, Paul McCartney, Bruce Springsteen, Guns N' Roses, Jonas Brothers, Green Day, Elton John, Billy Joel, Fall Out Boy, Pink, Jimmy Buffett, and others. Rascal Flatts became the first country act to perform in concert at Wrigley Field in July of 2009. New Year's Day 2009 saw a sports event unlike any other that had been held at Wrigley Field previously, when the Chicago Blackhawks welcomed the Detroit Red Wings for a hockey game in front of a packed house. While the Blackhawks lost 6-4 that day, it must have been pretty cool to be witnessing this bit of history on a cold Chicago day. Also in 2009, Tom Ricketts and his siblings purchased the Chicago Cubs and Wrigley Field. Ricketts is the son of TD Ameritrade founder J. Joseph Ricketts and was the co-founder and former CEO of InCapital LLC. While Wrigley Field received Chicago Landmark status in 2004, the national landmark status they received in 2020 was due in part to efforts by the Ricketts family. In January of 2013, the Ricketts family announced their 1060 project, a privately funded $575 million renovation of the ballpark to be completed over the following 5 years. The planned improvements included infrastructure, the ballpark's facade, restrooms, press box, the addition of restaurants and a jumbotron, a nearby hotel, and more. After months of negotiations with the city, the Ricketts plan was approved in July of 2013, with phase one of the renovation beginning on September 29, 2014. After the five-year renovation project, it has been said Wrigley Field's viability should be secure for the next 40 years or so, giving future generations a chance to enjoy one of the best ballparks, not only in the city, but in the world. A number of Wrigley-related topics I couldn't get to today, including professional wrestling, boxing, All-American girls baseball, the first international competition in softball, soccer, college football, professional basketball, religious revivals, a hippodrome, major motion pictures, and even rodeos at Wrigley Field. But fear not, I will likely do a Wrigley Field Extras episode soon so I can fill in some of the gaps. Today's episode about Wrigley Field, the Diamond on the North Side, was researched, written, narrated, and edited by me, Tommy Henry. I have links to some of the books I used for source material for this episode in the show's notes. As I'm recording this a few weeks before Father's Day, if you have a Cubs fan in your life, check out those links. As always, any of the items you purchase through those links, not just the ones I've listed, may generate a small commission and help offset the cost of making this podcast at no additional cost to you. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave a 5-star rating or even better, a written review, especially if you listen on Apple Podcasts, as it will help the podcast grow and reach new fans. Your review may be featured on a future episode or on social media. The Chicago History Podcast logo and the art used on these social media pages was created by John K. Schneider. Thank you very much, Johnny. If you need creative work done, email him at angeleyesartjks@gmail.com. I'll be back soon with another chapter in Chicago's amazing history. Until then, get out and explore when possible. Check out a Cubs game. Learn more about whatever city you live in, and stay safe.